Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the very last day of August. Tonight, President Obama will formally address the people of the United States, talking about the war in Iraq, and he will officially end the lengthy and divisive U.S. combat operation in Iraq. He will be, before he goes back to Washington, he's going to be at Fort Bliss, the Army base in El Paso, Texas, and will speak with the troops and then talk about the war that lasted more than 7 years, leaving more than 4,400 U.S. troops dead and thousands more wounded. And, of course, many Iraqis were killed as a result of this war as well. We are going to be talking about the past 7 years and about what you would like to hear the president say tonight as he talks about this war. What about those 50,000 troops remaining in Iraq? What will their mission be? And as Iraq had elections 6 months ago, it has a still-in-progress, somewhat dysfunctional democracy that has yet to seat a government. This is nearly 6 months after the election, but it's still a democracy. How does the United States help that government form if they should do anything? It's a fairly significant day, and we mark this day by talking about it this hour with Professor Paul Piller. He's Director of Graduate Studies, core faculty member of the Security Studies Program at the Center for Peace and Security Studies. He retired in 2005. From a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community, in which his last position was National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He earlier served in a variety of analytical and managerial positions, including as Chief of Analytical Units at the CIA, covering portions of the Near East, the Persian Gulf, and South Asia. He also served in the National Intelligence Council as one of the original members of its analytic group. Professor Piller is a retired officer in the U.S. Army Reserve and served on active duty in 1971 to 1973, including a tour of duty in Vietnam. Here's our phone number as we talk about what the president may say tonight and what's been happening in Iraq for the past 7 years and what this day means for the people in Iraq and for U.S. troops. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. We do want to remind you that at 7 o'clock tonight, we will be presenting special coverage from NPR News, and we'll present the president's address from the Oval Office. Robert Siegel with NPR correspondents and senior editors will be presenting live in-depth coverage and analysis. Here's our email address, too. I gave you the number, 800-486-8655. The email address is talk@WPR.org. talk@WPR.org. Professor Paul Piller, thank you so much for being with us.
Good morning, Kathleen. Nice to be with you.
So I want to talk first about the significance of this day. This has been a long time coming, hasn't it? 7 years is a long period of time. What do we have to show for it?
Well, we have to show something far different from and far less than what were the initial hopes and dreams of those who most fervently supported this war back in 2003. We've overthrown the dictator, of course, Saddam Hussein, but those larger hopes and dreams had to do with using Iraq as a kind of lodestar for the rest of the Middle East, an example that would set a path for economic and political transformation of the rest of the region. That clearly has not happened. And the other disappointments, of course, which have hurt us most directly and physically and painfully in the form of the casualties and costs that you summarized in your introduction, have to do with the disorder and the continued violence in Iraq. So beyond the overthrow of the dictator, it's really hard for me to see much positive that we have accomplished, and we're more in a, shall we say, a salvage operation, looking at the continued difficulties in Iraq and making difficult decisions about what else the United States can and should do to help the Iraqis.
The Iraqis have not been able to seat a government in the 6 months since the election. Will part of the 50,000 troops remaining there, will part of their mission be to help them form a government? Are we going to help them do this, or is it up to them now?
Well, it's up to them. I mean, there's not much that the U.S. military forces can do to resolve a political impasse among some Iraqi politicians. And this is another respect in which the toting up of the pluses and minuses over these last 7 years, another respect we have to take note of. There's been lots of talk, of course, about the surge of U.S. troops that President Bush ordered, and a general perception that the surge was a success, and which it was, of course, in contributing to a reduction in the violence back when it was at its worst around 2006 or so. But what the surge was supposed to do was to create space for Iraqi politicians to reach the political accommodations that they had to reach in order to make possible a new and more stable political order in Iraq. And that clearly has not happened. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, it the surge was not really a success, but we should never have expected that military and security operations could solve a political impasse, and we shouldn't expect that from our 50,000 troops who will remain there now.
This president, as you well know, was not in favor of American military action in Iraq. How would you judge what he has done in that country since he has been president?
Well, President Obama has had to walk a fine line here, and he's going to walk a very fine line in his speech tonight, between someone who, as a candidate, was opposed to the expedition from the very beginning, but once he assumed the duties as president, became the commander-in-chief, and clearly could not simply say this was a mistake, let's wash our hands of it, but rather had to make as much of a success out of it as he possibly could. And I think we've seen what it was the best possible solution he can derive from that difficult situation he's in politically, in much of his rhetoric that he's given us so far, which has been mostly upbeat. He has consistently, of course, lauded the accomplishments of U.S. forces, as he should and as we should, and talked about how the timeline for getting U.S. troops reduced and getting to the point we are today with this August 31st date, that had actually been set by the previous administration, that this has continued on schedule more or less successfully. And he's right to point to those things. But it really is a fine line he continues to walk between that of someone who's opposed from the war to the war from the very beginning to someone who has to command continued military operations today.
Tell me, please, Professor Pillar, what it is those 50,000 troops remaining will be doing.
Okay. Well, one thing we should dispel at the outset, Kathleen, is this idea that combat troops have left Iraq. I mean, this milestone that we've supposedly reached today is not so much a matter of troops having come out, although, of course, we have withdrawn a great number to get down to this level. It has been more an exercise in redefining the mission and relabeling combat troops to something else, support and assist or what have you. The biggest, or in my judgment, the most important mission they're going to still have is as a kind of fire brigade to back up Iraqi security forces with regard to any flare-ups or incidents or security problems that the Iraqis cannot handle. And beyond that, there's going to be a training mission, a very important one, in which the continued effort to try to increase the size of, and at least as important, the quality and ability of the Iraqi security forces will continue. So those two big things as a kind of reserve force and also an assister and trainer for Iraqi forces.
Does it not put those troops in increased danger?
Well, I don't know if it's increased or decreased. It's pretty much continued. And that's something that the American people are going to have to realize. And I expect that the president in his speech tonight will include enough words to try to remind us of this, that those 50,000 of our forces still face considerable hazards. And indeed, there could be some respects, if there are flare-ups, in which they are placed in more danger than they have been for the most of the last year or so.
And would that mean that we might consider sending more troops back?
I think for this president, it would be very difficult politically and in terms of maintaining an image of consistency in his policy to do that. The live issue, however, and one which has already come up for much discussion and debate among the Iraq cognoscente here in Washington, is should the next deadline, the one of December 31st, 2011, at which point we are supposed to have all our troops out of Iraq, according to the agreement that the Bush administration reached with the Iraqis, should that be extended? So the issue is not so much, I think, whether we're going to have another surge, but whether, and we will hear a lot of debate about this over the next 16 months, whether the presence of any U.S. troops should be extended beyond 2011.
Mm-hmm. And what about perhaps withdrawing those troops prior to December 31st, 2011?
Based on the continued security challenges, as well as the political impasse that even if we have an Iraqi government formed, will continue in other forms, I doubt very much that we are going to see an early departure of the last U.S. troop from Iraq. I think it will run up at least to December 31st of next year.
We welcome phone calls for you. We have all our lines filled right now, so just keep trying and you'll get through eventually. 800-486-8655 is the number. The email address is talk@WPR.org. And we start with Rich from Sullivan. Hi, Rich.
Hi. It was my understanding that the idea of the program is to suggest things the president might say. Is that correct? Or?
Sure.
Okay. Here's what I think the president might say. He might say that troops are sent by their leaders into combat situations, and our troops have served and have behaved honorably insofar as they were sent by their leaders to manage a situation militarily. I think he needs first to say that and then to say basically that we hear a lot of talk about safety nets and about moral hazard these days in the world of financial institutions and unemployment benefits and every place else. And if we were to apply that language internationally to the situation in Iraq, honoring our troops means that there is no honor to them in asking them to solve a political situation for which they are not trained militarily. And so I think the first thing he needs to do is to thank the military for what it has accomplished. And he needs to say, we suffer a moral hazard if we continue to say to the Iraqis, we're always going to be there for you in order to help you run your country. It's time for the Iraqis to take Iraq and figure out what it means as a nation and for the United States of America to slowly and carefully withdraw its supervision of the Iraqi nation. Any parent sending kids off to school on this weekend knows that there's a moral hazard involved in trying to live another young adult's life. And I don't want that metaphor carried too far. But what I'm not saying the Iraqis are children, but I'm saying the moral hazard to the United States is that if we behave as though they are children on the world stage, it's even worse than what we're saying now about a community center and mosque near Ground Zero in New York City. The world is watching what we're doing, and it pays attention to not what we say, but what we do. Thank you.
Thank you, Rich, for your thoughtful comments. Professor Piller.
I think Rich makes some very valid points, and I believe we're going to see some of his thoughts reflected in somewhat different language in the president's speech. He will, of course, talk about how our troops, having served honorably, can't solve all the political problems in Iraq, and I expect we will hear language along the lines of how the Iraqis have to, fulfill their own responsibilities for their own future. I basically agree with the point about moral hazard, and indeed, this is one that has been made in somewhat different form by Senator Levin, the chairman of the Senate Armed Services Committee, in previous discussion and debate about Iraq, in which he has made basically the same point, that as long as we are there with our forces, there is a tendency for the Iraqis to rely on us in a way that could continue indefinitely. And so I think Rich makes a very good point that there has to be some point where the Iraqis stick up for themselves.
Thanks, Rich. Pat in Richland Center. Hi.
Good morning. With Iraq, that's kind of, Washington destroyed the country, went in and invaded and destroyed the country, caused untold suffering in the cradle of Western civilization. You know, that'd be like burning down somebody's house and saying, hey, there you go, have a nice time and fend for yourself now that you got the burnt down house. But anyway, and now Washington, Pakistan is under water half the country, and Washington has still got their drones going around killing innocent people in Pakistan. I'd like to ask the professor if he could give us one example of how the president could reassure us that Washington could breed more ill will in the rest of the world than it has in, like, the last 10 years.
Well, this particular president, Mr. Obama, I think has a pretty strong basis for saying that he's done better than perhaps any of his other predecessors in reducing that kind of damage in the Muslim world in particular. And I hark back to his major speech in Cairo in June of last year, which was his effort to set a new tone in relations between the United States and Muslim countries from Pakistan to Egypt and across the Arab world. There's been a lot of criticism since then to the effect that those were wonderful words and a very good speech, but he hasn't followed up with the kind of action that would improve relations between the United States and many of these countries, such as Pakistan. The caller is quite right that things like the drone strikes in Pakistan have had a major downside with regard to popular resentment over the collateral civilian casualties that have come from those kinds of operations. And I would also agree, this goes back to your original question, Kathleen, about the sort of balance sheet of what we've achieved or not achieved in Iraq, that an awful lot of damage and destruction has resulted from this war, including Iraqi casualties, you know, well up into the six figures. But what can the president do? I think he can preserve the same kind of tone in his rhetoric and his speeches that he set in that Cairo speech, and make it clear that that the United States intends to be a partner with and a supporter of all of these countries, and certainly not just a destroyer and a disruptor.
The costs of this war have been so high, haven't they? I remember conversation after conversation after conversation we had 7 years ago as to the wisdom of this war. From the very beginning, what is a just war was something that some people were considering and some weren't considering. It's all been extremely difficult, and it started with the origins of it.
Well, let's just focus on the cost factor, which you rightly raised. We have the human cost. You mentioned the casualties at the outset, and we are still incurring casualties every week. This will continue as long as we have troops over there. Those have long-term consequences. We have disabled veterans, many very severely wounded, who will have to be cared for the rest of their lives. And then the monetary cost, I think through the end of last year, was something like up to $700 billion. With the meter still running, and economists like Joseph Stiglitz, the Nobel Prize winner, have written on this and tried to calculate what the eventual direct and indirect costs would be, and we're talking about multiple trillion.
Ooh.
This is when you factor in all of the indirect economic effects as well as lingering effects such as caring for veterans. Clearly, it was way, way beyond what the architects of the war had ever dreamed of or ever envisioned. In fact, we might recall back during the Bush administration, Mr. Bush's then economic advisor, Lawrence Lindsay, was fired because he made publicly, in response to an interview question, an estimate before the war that, well, it might cost something like $50 to $100 billion dollars. At the time, an embarrassingly high figure. The then chief of the budget office quickly came out and said, no, that's too high. It's probably going to be no more than about $50 billion. Well, of course, that's only a fraction of what it's turned out to be.
More phone calls in a moment. We're talking about the war in Iraq. The president is going to be tonight at 7 o'clock speaking from the Oval Office to mark the formal end of U.S. combat operations in Iraq. We will be carrying that this evening at 7 o'clock here on the Ideas Network. Professor Paul Piller is our guest. He is Director of Graduate Studies, core faculty member of the Security Studies Program at the Center for Peace and Security Studies. In 2005, he retired from a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community. He also is a retired officer in the U.S. Army Reserve and served on active duty, including a tour of duty in Vietnam. Our number, 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Second hour of our program today, how the weather had large consequences politically. This is a little known moment probably in American history, but it won't be after the next hour. The author of Hot Time in the Old Town, The Great Heat Wave of 1896 and the Making of Theodore Roosevelt. So that's coming up, hour number two. Let's go back to phone calls. Kenneth in Milton is next. Hello, Kenneth.
Hello. I'm hoping that President Obama recalls that President George Bush had Hans Gabby Blix desperately looking for nuclear weapons, and he told the dictator to throw out his nuclear weapons and come out with his hands up. And nothing came forth, so we went in there. And our troops, for the first time, faced a nuclear attack on a desert and had to go in under those conditions. Is what we've seemed to have forgotten in this conversation.
Professor Piller.
Well, the Bush administration, of course, had a couple of big selling points in mustering public support for an offensive war. One was the concept of weapons of mass destruction, including presumed nuclear weapons development. And the other was the issue of terrorist connections, including the supposed, which really never existed, alliance between the Saddam Hussein regime and al-Qaeda, and all of the rhetorical connection with 9/11. These were the selling points. They were not the primary motivators for the administration to go to war. The primary motivator was what I alluded to earlier, the desire, and this was right at the core of the neoconservative concept of foreign policy and what they hope to achieve in the Middle East, the idea of using regime change in this important Middle Eastern state, Iraq, as a stimulus for trying to achieve further economic and political reform in what is still a very backward authoritarian region with state-centric economies. The Middle East has been an affront to the U.S. victory in the Cold War, if you will. President Bush, you know, later, after the weapons of mass destruction did not materialize and the notion of terrorist links with al-Qaeda was also discredited, later came under a lot of criticism for shifting the rationale for the war when he talked about democratization in the Middle East and the sorts of themes that he struck in his second inaugural address. Actually, although one might say the criticism was justified in the sense of shifting rationales, the democratization theme was much closer to the truth about what the actual true motivator was. And as I mentioned earlier, that's been a bit of a disappointment too, although at least in Iraq itself we no longer have a Saddam Hussein dictatorship, but we have the makings of a admittedly very shaky democracy, but one that from Arab standards is more democratic than almost any other Arab state in the region, except perhaps Lebanon.
Thanks, Kenneth. Let's go to an email from Steve in Madison. In addition to 50,000 remaining U.S. troops, what's the population of civilian military contractor employees still in Iraq, paid either by the United States or Iraqi funding?
Oh, I don't have the an accurate figure for you, I'm afraid. Someone else may have it. Suffice it to say that we are in a transition from a primarily military to a primarily civilian-run set of responsibilities. The State Department, based on its enormous embassy in Baghdad, which, if I'm not mistaken, is now currently the largest U.S. overseas mission in terms of number of employees, has already been assuming more and more of the responsibilities for interacting with the Iraqis in various endeavors that had been performed by the U.S. military. Now, this in itself causes some challenges and problems for the United States, security being the biggest one, of course. The military can take care of itself. The State Department doesn't have its own army. And hence the stories we've been reading about the very strong emphasis on private security guards, contract personnel. And as long as we're going to have this transition from Pentagon responsibilities to State Department responsibilities, I'm afraid we're going to be seeing quite a bit of that for the indefinite future.
Hmm. We go to Christy from Milwaukee next. Hi, Christy.
Hello.
Hi.
This is Christy.
Hi.
Hi, thank you for this show. I was thinking about not just what the president might have to say this evening, but what I've heard in the past. And I just wanted to point out that he started out with a lot of beautiful speeches and flowery rhetoric that people just really went for regarding his being, you know, peacemonger and wanting to get all the troops out of Iraq, never mentioning, very cleverly, never mentioning Afghanistan. And the Christmas after he was elected, immediately sending all those troops in, more troops than we had ever had come from Wisconsin, I know, was the largest deployment since World War II. And I find what he has said up to this point, and whether he says anything tonight or not, I really don't know if I'll believe it, because I found what he said irresponsible to not only his devotees who supported him and helped campaign for him, but all the people who voted for him, including myself. And I just find it so irresponsible. I don't believe that he can actually implement what he says, whether he believes in it or not. He may, you know, very strongly believe in his own words. But I don't think, and I have never thought, that he would be able to implement these things because he had no power and he, you know, no connections in Washington. And I don't know how you feel about that, but it seems to have come to pass. What do you think will happen?
Afghanistan is another part of the political predicament that Mr. Obama has to some extent placed himself in, and I'm glad that Christy raised that subject because it really is the other big elephant in the room, if you will, in any discussion about where we are in Iraq. I'm sure the president will be saying something about Afghanistan tonight, perhaps a great deal about it. the basic predicament he placed himself in was in opposing the Iraq War, going back to when he was a candidate. One of his lines of argument, and this is one that many policy analysts have also stated, was that the Bush administration made a mistake in diverting attention and resources and troops to this expedition in Iraq when it should have been concentrating all along on Afghanistan, where the military operation known as Operation Enduring Freedom, a direct response to the 9/11 terrorist attack, began in the fall of 2001. Mr. Obama went beyond that. He said that Afghanistan, unlike Iraq, was a war of necessity, not just a war of choice. So he's really kind of boxed himself in. And the current strategy that he arrived at after that very lengthy policy review last year was a finely crafted political compromise, not just political. I mean, it was a sincere effort to try to take into account all of the security and military considerations. But the basic formula, you recall, was his own surge in Afghanistan, which is still ongoing, coupled with a timetable that would have the troops starting to come out of Afghanistan by July of 2011, less than a year from now. Now, that was an effort both to show that he's got gumption when it comes to national security affairs, that he was being consistent with his earlier talk about the importance of Afghanistan as a war of necessity, but at the same time, and this is where the July 2011 date comes in, reassuring people, including those on the liberal side of the political spectrum who supported him for election, that we were not going to stay in Afghanistan indefinitely. Well, looked at from the standpoint of counterinsurgency and the security problems in Afghanistan, it's a questionable formula, to say the least. If you look at counterinsurgency doctrine as formulated by General Petraeus and the other counterinsurgency experts, that's simply not enough time for accomplishing the counterinsurgency task that we've set out to accomplish in Afghanistan. And hence, all the talk that we've been hearing lately from General Petraeus, from Vice President Biden, who was one of the skeptics about this initially, and from others, that, well, come July 2011, don't expect a whole lot of U.S. troops to be coming out very fast. It might be little more than a token withdrawal. And I expect that may be the case. So one of the things that President Obama is dealing with here is precisely the kind of questioning and discontent in the electorate that Christie was expressing.
You have written pretty extensively on this, and I'd like for you to spend just a few more minutes on Afghanistan. You've said that the cost to the United States of this war are out of proportion to what is at stake in Afghanistan and how it affects U.S. interests. There's a lot in that. What are the costs to the United States? What is at stake in Afghanistan? I guess this might require more than a minute, and how it affects U.S. interests, and what's Plan B? What should be Plan B?
Well, Kathleen, here, let me frame it this way. We have set up for ourselves a counterinsurgency and the defeat of the Afghan Taliban and constructing a stable Afghanistan as a goal for ourselves in this war, while forgetting what it was all supposed to be about in the beginning and why we should be concerned about the Taliban or stability in Afghanistan at all. It was supposed to be all about terrorist threats to the United States. And, of course, we continue to hear this in administration statements. There's always the reminder that this was where 9/11 came from. You know, this was where al-Qaeda was back in September of 2001. Without going beyond that and asking the further, more pertinent and more up-to-date question of how much difference would it make in the terrorist threat to Americans in the United States or elsewhere for that matter, whether or not the Taliban insurgency succeeds or fails or whether or not we succeed or fail in a counterinsurgency. And there are a number of disconnects here in the unstated logic. One is the question of, would even a Taliban restoration to power in most of Afghanistan mean a restoration of an al-Qaeda safe haven in the country? And the answer to that, I believe, is no. Yes, these are both ideologically extreme groups, and yes, they certainly had an alliance and a partnership back prior to 2001. But one of the biggest, not just one of the biggest setback that the Afghan Taliban ever suffered was a direct result of the terrorist operations of al-Qaeda. That is to say, you know, our response to 9/11, Operation Enduring Freedom, which ousted the Taliban from its previous position of power. That's one consideration. Another point to make is that the Afghan Taliban is not a transnational terrorist group. It does not have the same kind of interest that bin Laden does in going after the United States, the far enemy, and using that as a tool to bring about Islamist revolutions in the Middle East. The Taliban doesn't care about any of that. They care about political power in Afghanistan, and they care about the United States only insofar as we are interfering with their ambitions with regard to political power in Afghanistan. And the last point on that particular issue is, suppose that despite all those considerations and despite the fact that bin Laden and his deputy Ayman al-Zawahiri seem to have survived pretty well on the other side of the Pakistan-Afghanistan border in northwest Pakistan, suppose they did try to recreate in Afghanistan something like the presence and the base they had prior to 9/11. Well, this time we would, to put it bluntly, bomb the heck out of it with our air power, even if we didn't have boots on the ground. The rules obviously were all changed at 9/11. And the final point, Kathleen, which with regard to a disconnect between the idea that the counterinsurgency in Afghanistan is all about keeping Americans safe from terrorists, is the question, how much difference does a physical safe haven in Afghanistan or anywhere else really make to what a terrorist group can do? And here I would just recall for your listeners that 9/11 itself, yes, it was accomplished by a group that had a safe haven in Afghanistan, but most of the actual preparations and the training and the planning took place elsewhere, in Spain, in Germany, and, of course, most of all, in flight schools right here in the United States. The fact is that the way transnational terrorists operate, they simply do not need any one physical safe haven, perhaps as much as they used to. And so this is not the critical difference in how much of a terrorist threat Americans will be facing in the future. When you take all those things into account and consider the cost that we're sustaining, human and material, in Afghanistan, that's the basis for my judgment that, no, it's the cost is not worth the benefit.
We'll have to do a full hour with you on Afghanistan down the road. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Tonight at 7 o'clock, the president will have a primetime address from the Oval Office, which will be carried here on the Ideas Network, to mark the formal end of U.S. combat operations in Iraq. And we're talking about that. You can't talk about Iraq without discussing Afghanistan, and we will have Professor Piller on to talk exclusively about Afghanistan, if he'll agree, down the road. He's a director of graduate studies, core faculty member of the Security Studies Program at the Center for Peace and Security Studies. And here is our number, 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Returning to phone calls, Habu from Madison is next. Good morning, Habu.
Yes, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. It's very interesting to listen to your guest, and I suspect it'd be no different than what President Obama has to say tonight. A lot of jive talk, prevarications, and, you know, these kinds of rationalizations. You know, it wasn't until about 35 past the hour when you read that email that there was talk about these mercenaries, which your guest euphemistically calls civilian responsibility, anywhere else, and to the Iraqis, they are known as mercenaries. So this is the kind of official spin that's going on, and I'm sorry to say, by our media, and this gives a distorted image to the hapless American population. But let me just get to two quick points. One is, you know, the whole thing about, well, if we leave it, there's going to be more violence and this and that and the other, and they can't get their political act together. We went there and broke a system which was working for them. Yes, they had a dictator, but that was for them to decide. And then now we kind of come with this circular argument that, well, we have to leave people there so that they get trained or this or that or the other. It doesn't devolve. But the second and more, of course, there's been pain felt primarily by the Iraqis and also by the American people, both by the families who've lost members, who have injured people come back and who'll need a lifetime of treatment, and most importantly, our treasury.
Right. I think our guest has made those points, Habu. I don't think there's a lot of jive talking going on here. Is there any part of that, Professor Piller, that you would like to respond to?
Well, it re-raises the legitimate issue, which we touched on just a bit before, about if the remainder of the withdrawal between now and December 2011 continues and we pull out completely at the end of 2011, will this leave, as some analysts here in Washington have already been suggesting, still too unstable a situation? And might we have to come to a new agreement with the Iraqi government to prevent this instability from spinning out of control? So we're going to hear a lot more about that. I mean, my own disposition on that issue right now is no, we should not be looking for ways to extend our presence. Yes, we should be glad that the Bush administration reached this specific accord with the Maliki government that gives us a particular goal to look forward to when we're out totally. And no, I don't think that the kind of instability that there may well continue to be in Iraq is going to spin out of control with a spreading civil war going across borders elsewhere in the region in a way that would cause irreparable harm to U.S. interests. The one other point that is implied in the caller's comments that, again, we might have just barely touched on before is a variation of the pottery barn rule argument that since we've broken so much in Iraq, then it's our responsibility to stay there long enough to fix it. Well, I don't look at it quite that way myself, particularly since we've been continuing to do more breaking as we've stayed there, and it's questionable how much we can really fix things. This gets back to that basic conundrum of how do you help from the outside Iraqis solve a political problem, which is really their own problem to solve.
Let's go to Jim in Milwaukee. Hi.
Hi. The whole thing reminds me of certain key words, waste, con games, and stupidity. And it reminds me of a line from a Skinner song regarding America, 7 years of hard luck coming down on me. Greenspan has already admitted that, from his point of view, that the war in Iraq was about oil, and we know that there is an intended pipeline from Turkmenistan, which is now ranked fourth in the world in oil and natural gas resources, located near the Caspian Sea. But ostensibly, of course, the reason for all of this is to promote democracy. And while Petraeus talks about winning the hearts and minds of the people, on a parallel course at home, the Republican Party encourages and tolerates abuse and stereotyping of Muslims. And just yesterday on MSNBC, they reported a situation where some ignoramus walked into a mosque during prayer service, swore at them, gave them the finger, and urinated on a prayer rug. And this may not be, this will be underreported in the American press, but it won't be underreported in the Arab press. And they'll portray us as a nation of ignorant yahoos engaged in the process of yihagraphy. So how are we going to win their hearts and minds in the long run?
Well, a couple of different issues there on the second one about the needless exacerbation of relations with the local population. Of course, there's unfortunately been a lot of that. Our commanders have done their best to keep it under control and to reduce it, but you know, the point is valid that these incidents that barely make it into the press over here, some of them become major stories in foreign populations, including the population in Iraq. So we have to make double efforts to be on our best behavior. The other issue that the caller raised concerned the role of oil. It's an oversimplification, as was often charged against the Bush administration, that this was all about oil. Oil did come into the thinking of the promoters of the war in two respects. One, Iraq's enormous oil reserves are part of what makes Iraq a very important country in the Middle East, and therefore part of what made it attractive as a lodestar, to use the term I used before, for further political and economic change elsewhere if we could accomplish regime change in Iraq. It's simply a very big part of the Middle East, and oil resources have a lot to do with it. The second way in which it factored in was the delusion among some of the biggest promoters of the war that because of that oil wealth, the war would basically pay for itself, and that rather than facing the hundreds and of billions of dollars of expenditure that we faced, that it would be war on the cheap. And indeed, some of the leaders in the previous administration specifically said, with all that oil, the war will pay for itself. And, of course, that hasn't worked out either.
Thanks, Jim, for the call. James in Hazel Green. Hi, James.
Hi. Okay. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My daughter's been in the service. Two brothers have been in the service. Two boys have been in the service. And they're all out now. But my question, I guess, for the general on the phone, or from the peace department wherever he's assigned to, is all these individuals that I talked to knew that George Bush Sr. had taken care of Iraq. We had half the country in Iraq covered with airplanes and our military from 1991 on. They knew there was no nuclear weapons there. They knew there was no weapons of mass destruction there. And I guess my question is why the Obama administration and why the senators and the congressmen who blew trillions of dollars on this war, they got time to take a ball player to court and charge him with lying to Congress on steroids, and not one person, not one individual in the political arena has charged anybody in the Bush administration for lying to Congress and lying to the American people.
Professor Pillen.
There was undoubtedly duplicity involved in the selling of this war. Most of that did not, however, take the form of outright specific lies where the president or official X said something and that something was factually wrong. Much more, it was a matter of rhetoric and of association of Iraq with 9/11, things of that nature. With regard to weapons of mass destruction, there was a widespread perception in and outside the government, among supporters of the war as well as opponents of the war, that the previous regime did have active programs to develop unconventional weapons, a perception that turned out to be, for the most part, wrong, although some aspects of it were correct. But, and here's where the deception without an outright lie really came into play. Part of that rhetorical drumbeat in selling the war was getting the American people and the Congress and everyone to believe that the existence of programs of weapons of mass destruction equated with the need to launch an offensive war. It didn't. As a matter of logic or as a matter of empirical attention to U.S. interests, we deal with other unconventional weapons threats all the time. We're dealing with a real nasty one in North Korea, for example. And it doesn't equate with a need to launch an offensive war against the regime involved. And yet this very year-and-a-half-long, very strong rhetorical effort, the campaign to sell the war, successfully instilled in enough people the idea that if there are these weapons programs, then we have to launch the war, that the administration got sufficient support to launch it. That is a form of duplicity, but it's not an outright question of lying, where someone can stand up and say that statement was false.
Professor Pillar, thank you so much. We'll watch the president with great interest and look forward to speaking with you concerning Afghanistan down the road. Thank you.
It's been my pleasure, Kathleen.
Our guest this hour, Professor Paul Pillar. He's director of graduate studies at the Center for Peace and Security Studies. He had a 28-year career in the U.S. intelligence community. His last position, National Intelligence Officer for the Near East and South Asia. He is a retired officer in the U.S. Army Reserve and served on active duty 71 to 73, including a tour of duty in Vietnam. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing this hour, and thanks to Chrissy as well for on-air production here in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. And thank you, everybody, for all of your calls. A reminder, tonight's address in the Oval Office by the president will be carried live here on the Ideas Network, and you can listen to it. We'll talk about it tomorrow. This is the Ideas Network.